From VinePair's New York City headquarters, I'm Adam Teeter.
And I'm Joanna Sciarrino.
And in Seattle, Washington, I'm Zach Jabal.
And this is the VinePair podcast. And just a reminder for all of you, you're going to hear the podcast that usually is on Friday this week starting to come to you on Thursday. And I'm going to remember at the end of this podcast to say, see you on Thursday, not see you on Friday. Anyways, Joanna, you just got back from Arizona.
Yeah.
Apparently Phoenix is a really hot cocktail city. So what you been drinking?
So Phoenix is a really hot cocktail
city.
But I was not in Phoenix. Oh. I was in Scottsdale.
Aren't they the same?
Yeah. I mean,
it's like right by next to each other,
30-minute drive, 40-minute drive to Phoenix. So, but however, I did not go to Phoenix. I really wanted to. I just didn't have the time to go check out the drinking scene there.
Found that on the job, even on your vacation.
I had some very expensive cocktails at a steakhouse/seafood restaurant in Scottsdale, because Evan and I decided we wanted to get their like Whistle Pig and E.H. Taylor cocktails.
What? Are you serious?
At $33
each.
Why?
Because your parents were the babysitter, so you're like, let's go hardcore.
Pretty much. Yes, my parents sent us out to dinner to this restaurant, which was very nice of them. We also had a bottle of Albert Bichot Fleury. That was really nice. Ooh. It was listed under the interesting reds section. They had interesting reds and interesting whites, which we thought was very funny.
What was the rest of the section? Just like Napa cabs?
Yep.
it's like anything that's not a Napa cab is interesting.
Pretty much.
That's so
oh, come
good.
On. There, oh, was, sorry, a, there was at least a Pinot Noir section.
They had a Pinot Noir section. Yep.
So they had a Pinot Noir section, a cab section, and then an interesting reds.
That's so good.
Yeah.
And you know, it's so funny. As I was listening to your Boise and Las Vegas episode, you, Adam, mentioned that the martini section at the place in Nevada had a all vodka martinis. Yeah. And then I looked back at the menu for this place in Arizona and their martini section were all vodka-based martinis. No, not a classic one in sight.
I know.
There were all these like weird kind of flirty vodka-based martini recipes. And it's, I was like,
which is why I think I'm going to get a little bit of shade thrown at me for last Friday's episode, because I feel like people are going to be like, you know, Adam, you're saying that the martini's been great for gin, but like only people are drinking it with vodka. Well, no, there's a lot of people drinking with gin too. Calm down. But especially Gen Z.
Good for both, right?
But calm down, boomer.
And you got to have vodka on your back bar, people.
You do. Yeah, you do. So that sounds like a lot of fun, though.
Yeah, so I also had some local Phoenix beers. One was from a brewing company called Wren House Brewing. I had a lager that was good, and Huss Brewing Company in it's in Phoenix, and it's called the Scottsdale Blonde, which was a Kolsch. That was good, too.
A lot of blondes in Scottsdale, to be fair.
The Scottsdale Blonde, yeah. Yeah, so that was good. But otherwise, didn't get to check out the bar scene too much in Phoenix. Maybe next time, though. What about you guys?
Come on, Zach.
Go.
So I got a jump start on my favorite time of the year, which is, of course, baseball season, which, as you all are listening to this, well underway, but as we're recording it, it's opening day, my favorite day of the year. And I took my son down to the Mariners park on this past weekend to check out some of the preseason festivities. And after leaving, he was hungry, unsurprisingly. So we grabbed some food, and I grabbed a beer from Elysian Brewing. Their Fields, just kind of like a classic ale, I guess you would call it. And I was like, you know, it kind of tastes like baseball season. So that was a standout for me this weekend. And, you know, it's very funny to me because Saul has like very suddenly gotten into sports after not being into them for most of his life. I mean, not that he's
How
that old.
How old is Saul, though?
He's almost six.
Yeah, so that's just, yeah, not surprising. Before that, like, you don't have the attention span as much, I feel like.
It's true. But now he's just, like, very into it, which is a little much for me because literally anytime any sporting event of any kind is, like, on a screen somewhere around him, not only does he want to watch it, which, fair, but he also asks me who I'm rooting for. And I just haven't had – I keep trying to explain to him, like, as an adult, you can't really have a rooting interest in a random, like, you know, midday, I don't know, like, tennis match or something. Like, I just don't care.
That's so funny. We took Mac to a spring training game and he didn't give a shit.
I would have been shocked
if he did.
Did
you see play?
The Diamondbacks and the...
You know what they should do? They should just send the Diamond...
That's the Seattle team.
The Mariners.
Yeah, oh, really?
It must have been the Mariners.
Wow, you just insulted
the Seattle team.
I think it was Seattle.
It could be.
Good. You'd be like, you're like me. I would just go there and not pay attention either. It's baseball. Yeah. Who cares? But I think it'd be hilarious if... they sent the Diamondbacks, be like, well, you guys play in Arizona all the time. We're going to send you to Florida.
Yeah, right.
Like, go to real spring training like the rest of them. So for me, over the weekend, Naomi and I had this thing of just like, fuck it, we're going to open Nice Wine. So on Friday night. YOLO. On Friday night, we opened this bottle of Belcole Reserva 10 Anni Barolo 2013. I think that this wine's great. Mm-hmm. I had it for the first time a few months ago and then got another bottle of it. And I think it's great because the winemaker purposely holds his Barolo for 10 years and then releases it. Okay. He makes lots of Barolos, but this one, which I think is just super cool and very unique. We actually reviewed this vintage on the site, gave it a 94. It's again, I think there's so many more producers who I wish did stuff like this. You don't have to do it with all of your releases, but like it's great that he's able to do it, and nice because you get to drink old Barolo. And do you guys know how much this wine is retail?
I imagine a lot.
No.
$62.
Whoa.
So nice. We drank a 10-year-old Barolo on a Friday night, and like I didn't feel that bad about opening it. And then on Saturday night, we were like, let's open really nice wine, and we opened Montevertine Rosa Toscana, which that's a great wine. Mm-hmm. And I made pizza, and it was like really fun to have this delicious, you know, wine with the pizza. And Naomi was like, wow, this is, I mean, we'd had it when we were in Chianti like 2 years ago, and I'd bought a bottle there, and I was like, let's just open it. And it was a lot of fun and really delicious. And yeah, those were my two highlights over the last week.
Do you have a wine fridge?
Sounds great.
I do. Mm-hmm. It's in the closet.
Okay.
That's why you don't see it, like in that big closet. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Where the rest of the alcohol fell.
Yes, but that alcohol's not there anymore now. But yes, it's in the closet, and it works well there. And it only holds 24 or 36 bottles or something. I feel like wine fridges never hold what they say they're going to hold. I think I have a 36-bottle wine fridge, and maybe it holds 24. Do you know what I mean? Like, do better, wine fridge companies.
Big business.
Big business, but like maybe tell – like be more accurate on the amount of bottles it will hold. Because – let's be honest, it doesn't hold what you say it holds, and that's false advertising, and I should take you to court. Anyways, that's my weird thing on the bottles. But we have another listener question this week, and first I want to say thank you for all of you that send these questions in. It's awesome. We're going to start answering some of them at the end of podcasts, but this one definitely warranted a full conversation. So, Zach, play it away.
Hi, Adam, Joanna, and Zach. My name's Dale, and I'm calling from the Bay Area in California. Longtime listener here, and love what you guys do at Vine Pair. So recently, a few Napa Colt wineries released their allocations, which has sparked a lot of chatter on the internet about Napa wine prices. I've been fortunate enough to taste some of these Colt wines, but I don't have the money to purchase them myself, considering they often range from like $500 to well over $1,000 a bottle. Anyways, so all the talk has gotten me thinking, and I'd like to pose a couple of questions for you guys. First, are these Colt wine prices and high-priced Napa wines truly worth the money? I know grapes and labor and materials are expensive in Napa, but many argue that there's smaller Napa wineries making great juice for less. Second, do you think there's always going to be a market for these Colt wines and that prices will continue to go up? And finally, as younger generations hopefully get more into wine, do you think they're going to take less of an interest in these high-priced wines and cause the wineries to shift their strategy? I love Napa as much as the next NorCal gal, but I'm beginning to think that I'm getting priced out. Looking forward to hearing you guys' thoughts on this, and thanks for all you do.
All right, Dale.
Thank you, Dale.
What a great question. Thanks for being a longtime listener as well.
This was really shocking to me.
Really? Why?
Because that's a lot of money for wine.
It is.
$900, over $1,000 for a couple bottles.
Oh, I mean, there's wines that will sell just for one bottle at that.
Yeah, it's crazy.
I mean,
and when it's not like at auction, like that kind of thing. Like I get that market a little bit better than this.
So here's the thing. I think it's a really interesting question. I do not think in just snap reaction, I don't think Colt wine's ever going away. And the reason for that is because as we continue to have this massive economic disparity in this country where there are a group of people that are making way more money than they know what to do with and another group of people that are making not enough money, right? The people that are making way too much money are going to always look for ways to spend that way too much money. And one of the ways is on fine luxury items. You look at the watch market and it's out of control. People are trying to get, you know, as many Rolexes as possible. You look at the, you know, Hermes is trying to now create a new Birkin, right? So another really exclusive bag, because there's such a demand for Birkins that they just, even though they're trying to be exclusive with who they sell them to, there's so much demand they need something else, right? You look at the car market, you look at wine, you look at art. Like, it's just people who have this money want to spend it. I've had winemakers in Napa who have told me that they have customers who ask them if they make anything else more exclusive. Like, and a lot of it is being fueled by Silicon Valley.
Sure.
It's the regulars that drive up from Silicon Valley. And what I think is really surprising is one winemaker who's at a very famous estate, friend of the pod, has told me that they have customers in millennials, right? Millennials who are in tech, who will come and say, you know, yeah, I get that this is the bottle that you guys have that's won all the awards and blah, 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 but like, I would pay more for something even more exclusive. And I think there's a lot of that in California that is driving this market and will always continue to drive this market, because people want to have something that is hard for other people to have. Do I think that that is good for overall wine? No. But I also think that what it says is, like, I think we're going to have two markets emerge. We're going to have, like, wine that emerges for the general consumer that's, like, again, still the fine wine consumer. I'm not talking about two markets, like, there's
grocery
going to be
store.
Right, there's the grocery store. Like, no, I'm talking about still wine connoisseurs like ourselves who are going to say, we care about maybe the wines that this winemaker makes that are his estate bottles that we can't afford every once in a while, and then the other great wines that come out of, you know, the majority of the world. I'm thinking, like, even wines like Massacan, et cetera, right? They're like, they're fine wines, but they're not unattainable wines. And then we're going to have these cult wines, and we're not going to give a shit about them. And I think the only people that are going to give a shit about them are the people who are friends with these people that also have money. Like, they're going to care, and they're going to be courted by the producers that make these cult wines, and they're going to be invited to super high-end experiences to buy these cult wines, and we're not even going to be aware of them or give a shit.
Right. I think that part of the DAO conversation was like this, right? Like, we were talking about how it's more of a status thing. It's a lifestyle thing. I don't think DAO is as expensive as these, right?
No.
Yeah.
No. Like, I've never heard of Scarecrow. I've heard of Continuum. But yeah. I've never heard of
Well, that
Scarecrow
was the thing
before.
I was going to say here is, like, what's interesting about this conversation is I think you could take some of these cult Napa wineries, like the names, and ask them to people who consider themselves wine connoisseurs, pretty in the know. And yeah, some of them would be like, what is this? Or if they've heard of it, they've certainly never tried it.
Yep.
Yeah.
And I think that, like, it's really interesting because I'm actually curious the two of your thoughts on this, because I think it helps kind of maybe unpack this question a little bit, is with some wines in the world that are very highly priced, the thing that's caused the price to skyrocket, and in particular where Joanna was mentioning before, the price at auction, sort of the secondary market, is that they become kind of collector's items, right? Like, the idea is that you buy these bottles, and many of the people buying them may be themselves just doing so as an investment. They're hoping to resell it in 5 or 10 years for even more money. Mm-hmm. And what's unclear to me about these cult Napa wines is, like, is that what these people, a significant number of these people, are buying them for? The idea being that there will be a resale market for this wine 10 or 15 or 20 years down the road? Because I'm skeptical of that. Or is it just that the sort of very wealthy tech money folks who are buying these wines are drinking them? They're planning to drink them. Mm-hmm. They might hold on to them for a while. And they're just going to have a drinking experience. They're going to be drinking a product that, as I mentioned before, like, very few people have even heard of.
So I think it is the latter. I think it is the – so it's really interesting. This morning, actually, I had coffee with a friend who went to Stern with me, so to business school, and he and I were actually on the team that won that Bordeaux Cup, like, wine tasting championship.
Okay.
And he has now moved to D.C., and his wife went to – Dartmouth and then HBS, and we were joking that we, like, slummed it, and, like, I went to Emory, and I forget where we went to undergrad, and then we went to Stern, like, mm-hmm. whatever, like, it's funny, like, Dartmouth and HBS have very tight, very successful alumni networks, and mm-hmm. he had said that they had come into I was asking why he was in town, and, like, they had some business, but, like, the night before, so last night, they were in Greenwich, mm-hmm. At, like, a very intimate, like, alumni gathering of people she'd gone to HBS with.
Okay.
And one of the guys had flown in from California, I think from Silicon Valley,
on his private jet,
and had brought these wines to pair with this dinner they were doing at a chef's table in Greenwich. And he said, like, he brought Margaux, he brought Chateau Mouton Rothschild, he brought a Grand Cru, I think Montrachet. Like, he brought very expensive wines, and he bought them to drink them because he's fucking rich. And I think that that's where these exist. And I think what's interesting is part of where I think cult wine is going to be, will never be a thing for the majority of consumers, and why we'll never care, is that for us, that we'll only have a few instances in our lives to drink them. They're never going to be, for us, worth the
it.
Price.
Yeah.
Or be like, this was fine.
Right. This is part of Dale's question.
Yes.
Like, is this it really was, worth it?
I don't think so. I think if you are in the upper echelon of wealth, it is such a status symbol, and you will be able to drink them so often that you just are like, yeah, they're amazing, because that's what you drink. Because this is the thing that you have to understand about dumb money. Like, when you have dumb money, that's the kind of shit. This is nothing. Because, again, the kinds of wines this guy was opening at this dinner were the wines he drinks all the time, he was telling my friend. Like, these are the wines he has in his cellar. He's buying wine because he doesn't know what else to do with his money. And so he's buying all these high-end wines, and he's just popping them. So he brought wines, didn't even think about it, just bought them. And again, that is the kind of money that is existing in this very upper echelon of American society at this point in time. And in the world, these are who is driving up Burgundy prices.
Yeah.
And so.
But then I think another part of, I'm sure that a majority of the people buying these wines are those types of people. But I do think that there is probably consumers who don't have gobs of money, who try to pursue wines like this. And because of the very wealthy people, the prices do go up, right? Because these companies are like, you know, they know that they capitalize on people's interest and loyalty for their products, right? So they raise the prices, and then you have these people who have less money still trying to get these wines.
Yeah.
I think that happens too. And like, people save their money to buy these wines. And that's why I think this question is like, are they worth it?
I don't think they are.
Yeah.
I mean, any of the really expensive wines I've had in my life, I've always been like, they're fine. Like, none of them have been like, the only wines that have ever blown me away have always been like usually older vintage wines that are from really famous regions in the country or the world, but like never the most famous wine of that region or of that place, right? Like, it, because those wines are so unattainable. And for example, I honestly do not give a shit if I ever drink Screaming Eagle in my life. I really don't care. I'm not interested. Like, I don't think it's going to blow me away. I'm just going to think, wow, I'm drinking $1,000 or something, right, Zach, at that point? Isn't that what it's like, bottle of wine? I really don't care.
Yeah. It,
you got to tell, like, did God kiss the grapes? Like, what happened? Like, because I really don't understand. You're telling me that this place where this comes from and this person, it's worth that much more than the other Cabernet that comes out of Napa? I just don't believe you.
Yeah.
And it's the same with, like, okay, think about, like, Brunello Cucinelli makes amazing cashmere, right?
Mm-hmm.
But is his cashmere that much better than other designers' cashmere? No. Like, it's just not. Are little angels knitting the cashmere, and did they pet the sheep the entire, like, shut up.
I'm with you, Zach. I'm curious to know, like, similarly.
You want
to
try it.
No. I'm curious to know about Zach, because I do think that there are people out there who are like, it's the hottest restaurant. They're going to wait online for it 3 hours. You know, like, it's the most expensive wine. They've got to have it. They're going to save money to do it. Like, the most obscure, hard to get.
And that's why they're not going
to
be able to retire.
Bourbon, like, they're going to seek it out.
Yeah.
Right? Like, those types of people. And I think that's why this exists, because they are out there, right?
Well, it's interesting, and I realize I'm talking again, Zach, and I apologize. But, like, I had this conversation. Okay. But I'm curious what you guys think. Like, I had this conversation again recently with some people. Actually, people who run a big restaurant, like high-end restaurant and hotel PR firm. And we were saying, we don't remember when we were in our early 20s, like, always having to go to the hottest new restaurants, especially in New York. But that, like, we find that people we know that are younger, Gen Z, et cetera, that really, like, this is on their bucket list. And everyone's telling me they think that's because of social media.
Mm.
And, like, I think there is a group of people that are sharing these wines on social, that they get them, whatever. And then if you are a keeping up with the Joneses type of person, right, of which I believe, like,
the personality,
right, like, mm-hmm, that, then yes, you feel like you gotta have it. Yep. I think, you know, Dale, I don't know how old you are, but I think that there is some perspective gain from different generations who just think, you know what, like, it's not for me. I there's other things I want to have in my life. Like, I don't need to, like, I like the affordable luxuries. I like a nice hotel. I'm not an Airbnb person. Never going to be an Airbnb person. Like, I'm sorry, when I go on vacation, like, I like a hotel. I'm not clean enough for myself on vacation. Sorry. But, like, I like a nice restaurant every once in a while. I like nice wine. I really do. I love wine. Everyone knows that's my first love in terms of alcohol. But, like, I just don't care about these wines that are so expensive that you are never going to convince me they're worth the price.
But yeah, if someone offers them to you, will you drink them?
I'll try it, yeah. But I think I will be
I won't like it.
I'll probably be way more critical of it than I would be otherwise. Like,
that's fair.
Like, you think about it, you know, about the things we talk about in New York, like the line waiting.
Yeah.
There is a bakery in Brooklyn that I think is totally fucking overrated.
Yeah.
And why do I think that? Because I know how long people wait in line for these stupid croissants and things they do. And I'm just like, I've had them before and they're not that good. They're fine.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and you know what? If someone had brought me over the croissants and hadn't told me where they were from and I didn't know they waited in line for them or whatever, I'd probably be like, this is a good croissant.
Right.
But because I know everything else, yeah, I'm just more critical.
Or if you didn't have to wait in line for it, you'd be like, oh, it's pretty good.
Pretty good.
Yeah.
But like waiting, sorry.
Yeah.
I don't care.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to say two things about this. One of them is actually something that Dale mentioned in the question, which I think is a really good point and something to be aware of. For me, I tend to lose interest in wine once the price has become so far detached from what I consider to be a sort of the reasonable markup on the cost of production, right? So, you know, you can look at something like some of the very expensive Burgundy and you can kind of understand a little bit why the prices at, you know, sort of when they sell them originally, not the secondary market, but just the initial pricing is what it is, because we're talking about very small pieces of land with relatively low yields that are, yes, also in very high demand. I think one of the things with some of these Colt Napa wines in particular is, you know, the vineyard sourcing isn't always super transparent. It's not like we're talking about a tiny little vineyard in the absolute most ideal corner of Napa. It's like sometimes they're sourcing from throughout the valley. And like, obviously, Napa Valley Cabernet is expensive no matter where you get it from, and some of it is significantly more expensive. But even if you're getting it from the absolute most expensive vineyard plots, it's not $600, $700, $1,000 a bottle expensive. It just isn't. So now what am I paying for? Well, I'm paying for marketing. I'm paying for, you know, sort of possibly artificially inflated demand, et cetera. And look, as you said at the top, Adam, there are people for whom that kind of conspicuous consumption or just, hell, I've got the money, why wouldn't I spend it on the most expensive wine I can? Fine. But I just, I've tried some of these wines. I haven't tried all of them. You know, sometimes you get little tastes of things. I think often they're good. You know, they're not, they're certainly well-made wine. Some of them are pretty tasty. If I had them without any context and had them with no notion of the price, yep, I might think they were quite good. But again, I just can't, like you, I can't get the price out of my head. Like, you sit down and taste. It's no different than anything else, right? You know, you have to take the price tag into consideration with anything you're trying out. Like, I can try on a pair of jeans and be like, oh man, these are, you know, they feel comfortable. I think they look good on me. But if you tell me they're $1,000, I mean, they're not going to make me look like someone I'm not, sadly. And so I'm not going to buy them, no matter how comfortable they are or how, you know, stylish they are or whatever. And other people might deem that $1,000 worth it, or they might, $1,000 might just mean a lot less to them than it does to me. Cool, fine, whatever. Those products exist for those people, and undeniably these wines largely exist for that kind of person. I do think that the other thing to take note of here, though, in terms of like, will these ever escalating prices drive people away, is that I do think that there could be, you could reach a tipping point with at least some of these labels where, you know, right now part of what's allowing them to continue to kind of bring pricing up and up and up every year is there's more demand than there is supply, right? I didn't have to go to business school to know that. But I do think that we could run into a problem where more and more of these wines are out there. There are new cult, quote unquote, cult Napa wines every year. And if some non-negligible percentage of the would-be audience for these is deciding at some point, you know, maybe I don't want to spend $2,000 on three bottles of wine, I'll pass. it doesn't, I think, take a ton of that happening on a number of the different wines to see some real erosion of the would-be consumer base. Because while there are a lot of very, very wealthy people in the world or even in this country, there are not an infinite number of them. And I do think we are getting to a point. I mean, I think we've all been subjected to a number of different press releases. You see more and more wines and, you know, their individual wineries or newly created wineries trying to play in this space. And like, I don't know. I think there is some risk of oversaturation because in the end, there isn't, in Napa in particular, I think there isn't the same, you know, you're not dealing with Grand Cru status stuff where there is just a fixed amount of it.
And
right?
So much history there.
Yeah. You can't make, you know, to go back to the example Adam was giving before, you can't make Le Montrachet a bigger vineyard. Like, it is a defined, limited space. And therefore, you know, only so much wine can be made from it, even in a good year. And certainly there are some bad years. And with kind of quote unquote Napa Cab, it's not infinite, but it's there's a lot more potential wine out there than there is in even in Burgundy as a whole, say, to say anything of the Grand Cru vineyards. And so I just think, you know, where we are, there could be, you know, kind of a oversupply at some point in this market.
Yep. Look, I think, again, if you think about all of it, right, it's a machine in terms of how these things get cranked out, right? I think the winemaker or winery that decides they want to do this, you hire a very high profile winemaker to make the wine. There is no way there's not a little payola going into this where you get someone who's a well-known critic and you wine and dine them and you let them know how much the wine's selling for, and maybe you let them stay at your property or maybe you give them a case of the wine and you get a really good score. And then this community as well of these sort of clout chasing, you know, cult wine obsessives learn about the new cult wine and they drive each other to buy it. Like, it's,
and that, it goes up. Price goes up.
That's how high-end fashion works, too. It's how high-end art works. So it's the same kind of idea, right? And you know who you're going to. You know who to grease the wheels with, like all that stuff. And you have your cult wine. Now, how long does that last for? Who knows? Is it worth most people's time? Probably not. You have to be very strategic. This is the audience you're going for to make these cult wines. You know, I think there's... I think a lot of the producers in Napa are much better off making the quality Cabernet they make, and it's going to be expensive anyways, folks. It's Napa Cab. Like, it is what it is. There's going to be a market for it. And, it, you know, for the majority of us, I don't think we need to obsess over it. I don't think it's something that matters that much. It's interesting as a business concept to be aware of it and, like, look at it from its marketing perspective. But, like, if someone names this wine to you and you don't know it, who gives a shit? Like...
There's so much wine out there.
Yeah, there's so much wine out there. These are such a blip, Dale. And so, like, I actually don't think you should ever care about whether or not you've tried them or worry about trying them. They just don't matter. And with that, Joanna and Zach, I'll see you on Thursday.
Thursday,
yeah. Y'all, I remember.
Oh, my God.
Can't wait. It's so soon.
Yeah, have a great... Yeah, it's so great. You're going to hear from us so much sooner than before. And it's going to be... And we're just... Your ears are going to be so happy.
Sounds great.
Thanks so much for listening to the Vine Pair Podcast, the flagship podcast of the Vine Pair Podcast Network. If you love listening to this show, or even if you don't, but I really hope that you do, as much as we really do love making it, then please drop us a review or a rating wherever it is that you get your podcast, whether that be iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, anywhere. If you are listening to this on a device right now, through an app, however you got this audio, please drop a review. It really helps everyone else discover the show. And now for some totally awesome credits. So, the Vine Pair Podcast is recorded in our New York City headquarters and in Seattle, Washington, in Zach Jabal's basement. It is recorded by Zach, mastered, and produced by Zach. He loves all the credit. Keep giving it to him. Drop his name in the reviews. He's going to love hearing how much you love him. It is also recorded in New York City by our tastings director, Keith Beavers, who is the managing director of the entire Vine Pair Podcast Network. I'd also love to give a shout out to our editor-in-chief, Joanna Sherino, who joins us on every single podcast as our third and most important host. Thank you as well to the entire Vine Pair staff and everyone who's been involved in making Vine Pair as special as it's become. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next week.